Wade Alcoholic.
Wade.
And thank you, James, for asking me to come down here and do this. Thank you, Darden, for your share. Welcome to the two newcomers. Glad that you could make it. Let's see. I'm nervous. I don't know why. I don't normally get nervous, but for some reason I am today. Just a little bit about myself. I was born in Seoul, South Korea, and left in a basket at a police station, adopted by white Mormons. I'm in Utah. I'm gay, and that's why I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. The reason why I say that, though, is because for a long time, those kind of excuses and that ability to make myself unique and different from you is what kept me out of the rooms and kept me from identifying with you as another alcoholic. And my original sobriety, the very first sobriety date that I got was January 15th of 2001. And my current sobriety date is January 30th of 2010. So I spent about 9 years in and out of the program trying to prove myself an exception to the rule. I did everything that it talks about in the third chapter, more about alcoholism and more. And I did everything that I could possibly do to prove myself not one of you. When I came into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous and I sat down and I listened to your stories, I would find everything that you said that I could possibly use as a reason why I wasn't one of you. I didn't drink in the morning. I only drank in the bar. And I tried to find an excuse for why it was okay for me to drink, because that's the way my disease works. My disease is cunning, baffling, and very powerful, and it convinces me and it created opportunities for me to drink in any way that I could. It's kind of like this. How many of you guys drank when you had money? When you didn't have money? When you had somebody else's money? When you had a boyfriend, girlfriend? You'd just probably keep your hands up, right? Because see, what that tells me is that it's not the circumstances that caused me to drink, even though I'd like to use those as the reasons. And that was the obsession of the mind for me, finding any reason why I deserve to drink. I'm Asian. I'm adopted. You're all white. With the exception of a couple of minorities in here. Thank you. And I would love to use those excuses. And that was the obsession for me. It was trying to find anything that I could do to convince myself why it was okay for me to drink. And what happened to me is when I drank, a phenomenon of craving kicked in. And what that means is that I could not guarantee you that every time that I drank that I could control my drinking. Sometimes I could, and boy, did I hold on to those. And another excuse for why I wasn't one of you, because there was that one or two times that I could control my drinking. But the third and most important part for me that I've learned in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I also suffer from a spiritual malady. And what that means for me is that I drank so much that I became so disconnected from all of you, from my family, my friends, my parents, from everybody. That's what I attribute to when people say that I could be in a room full of people, my closest friends and family, and still feel alone. That was the spiritual malady. That was the spiritual disconnect, that I couldn't relate to any of you and I felt alone all the time. I didn't have a very long drinking career. I was one of those good little Mormon boys. I went on a mission for a little bit and came home early because I missed my mom. I used to tell people it's because I was gay. Battling that battle, but really what it was, I missed my mom. And I was that good little Mormon kid, but when I turned 21, that's when I decided to have my first drink, because I was going to do everything legally. I was going to do everything right. And I had my first drink at a house party. It was a fuzzy navel, and kind of a fitting drink for me. But and I remember getting so drunk at that party. I also smoked some weed upstairs, too. And it was for the first time in my life that I felt okay with myself. That I wasn't Asian. I wasn't alone. I wasn't adopted. I wasn't Mormon. I wasn't gay. I just felt okay. And I chased that for a few years until I finally was doing some other extracurricular activities. And San Diego City decided that it'd be okay for me to either go to jail or go to rehab. And I remember before I was arrested that night, I had this feeling, don't go out. You've done well enough that week. It's not necessary for you to go out. But I said, no, just one last time. But geez, I'd really like to get out of this. And my higher power works in a mysterious way, and I was arrested that night. And I was in jail, and I was crying. I called my mom. I'm bawling on the phone, you know, and swore I'd never do it again. Got out of jail a week later, and I was doing the exact same thing. When I finally went to rehab, which was one of the conditions, I stayed sober for about a year and a half. But I was only a drug addict. I didn't have a problem with alcohol. It was just drugs. Drugs were the problem. And after a year and a half of not really working any steps, not really calling my sponsor, I heard a guy that had 5 years had decided he was just a drug addict too and he was going to go out and drink. I said, well, that's a good idea. If a guy with 5 years who's an old timer, then I guess I could go out too and drink like a gentleman. And so I went out for a year. And this is how cunning and baffling that this disease is for me. I went out for a year and I drank like a gentleman. I only had 2 drinks at the bar. Convincing myself that if I only had 2 drinks, then I'm drinking like a gentleman and you would have to take your hat off to me. At that year marker, I would make sure that I was kind of looking for that AA person that still liked to go to the bars that was sober, and they would see me and I'm like, yeah, I've been controlling my drinking for a year. They're, oh, well, I guess our hats are off to you. I said, thank you very much. That was all I needed. And for the next 6 months, I caught up for that whole year. Alcohol, for me, put me in places that I never thought I would be. I did things that I never thought I would do. And I hurt the people that I never thought I would hurt. When I finally came back this last time, I remember going outside of work. I'll explain to you what happened. And then what had happened is I learned that there was this white powdery substance that if I took while drinking, I could drink more. And I wouldn't black out. And I wouldn't have those embarrassing moments that everybody would tell me I had. And I remember I had drank so much, and I was trying to compensate with that other stuff so I could keep drinking. And what ended up happening for me is that I blacked out, but I got to watch my blackout in third person. And I saw everything that I had taught, that I didn't believe that I did. And I saw the hopelessness, the incomprehensible demoralization. And I was sick to my stomach, and I knew that this was it. So my choice was either to kill myself or maybe try AA one more time. And I remember looking outside, and I said, God, I don't know if you're out there or if I believe in you, but if you exist, I need help or I'm going to kill myself. And I had this feeling, go upstairs on your work computer and find a meeting. Found this meeting. It was called Candlelight, and it was at 9:45, I think, at the time. And I went up, and the whole time I'm driving up there, I'm bargaining. At this point, even though I had that moment of clarity to go to a meeting, I was still bargaining with God. If nobody says hi to me at this meeting, I'm never coming back to AA, because then I know I don't belong there either. I went up, and I sat behind this little tiny blue pole. It was about this big, hoping that nobody would say hi to me, but at the same time hoping that somebody would come say hi. And a young man came up to me, and he said, you know, I don't recognize you. My name is so-and-so. What's your name? That night, that man saved my life. Because then at that point in time, I had completely surrendered. And I gave my will and my life over the care of God as I understood him at that moment and said, okay, I'll give this another try. And I put everything that I had into my program and into everything that I was told to do so I could stay sober. I'm a part of WIPA in Salt Lake City. A lot of people have their opinions about WIPA, and that's okay. But for me, Young Peoples of Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a place where I could feel comfortable and at home. Young People in Alcoholics Anonymous gave me people that I could relate to. Young Peoples in Alcoholics Anonymous said that I could still have fun. Young People in Alcoholics Anonymous gave me people that I could relate to on a level that I needed to relate to. And for that, I'm grateful. Had there not been a YPAW, I don't know if I would have been sober. But because of YPAW, I have friends all over this country, that know me and I know them. That if I'm ever in their state, I can go there and stay there. I'm staying at a friend's house that I met in San Diego, 10 years ago? I'm staying at his house. When I come into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was when I came back through one of the relapses that I came back through, I was one of those completely self-absorbed people. And whenever I went into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and they said, the newcomer is the most important person in the room, I said, yes, I am. I am the single most important person in that room. And this guy that knew me so well came up to me and says, Wade, you don't get to be the most important person in this room today because you've spent your whole life being the most important person in any room that you walked into. So today you just get to be one of us. And what that means is that that's the anonymous part of Alcoholics Anonymous for me today. It's not just about being anonymous in press, radio, and film, but it means that when I go into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I get to sit down and be no less than and no better than anybody else in that room. That we're all equal, and that we're all the same people just trying to do the same thing. And when I grasped onto that identification of anonymity is when my sobriety changed yet again. Because now I don't have to feel like I'm different or unique. Because I realize that it's those three things that I talked about earlier that make me an alcoholic and make me one of you. And then I can sit down across from another man and have a conversation about sobriety and how I'm staying sober today, how they're staying sober today, and we can relate to each other because of those three things. It doesn't matter where we come from. It doesn't matter what we've done in our past, but that we're here because of the common solution. The first weekend of August is when I had my spiritual experience where the obsession of alcohol was removed from me. There was a meditation exercise that they do that they tell you to close your eyes and you're laying on your back and they're describing a treasure chest that's in front of you. And in this treasure chest is the one thing that you've always wanted your entire life. Before I opened up my chest in my mind going through this guided meditation, I was thinking I wanted the car, I wanted the house, I wanted the good job, I wanted notoriety, I wanted fame, and those were the things that I wanted the very most in my life. When I went up to my treasure chest and I opened up the lid, there was a bright light inside that treasure chest. And I reached into that treasure chest and brought that ball of light up to my heart. And I was transported into standing before my Creator. And He said, "Welcome home, my good and faithful servant. And how dare you hate yourself when I created you in my image?" And I realized at that moment, more than anything else in the world, all I wanted to know was that God loved me and that God had made me the way I am today and that there is nothing wrong with Wade. The obsession was removed that day. For that, I've never looked back. The obsession has not returned. And I no longer feel bad about being gay. Because I know my power, my higher power, my God loves me. Today I work with other alcoholics. I am of service. I help bring YPAW to Salt. Well, rebring YPAW to Salt Lake City, because I knew how much that would help me and why it was so important to me. Today we have a thriving young people's community in Salt Lake City. We are hosting SWACIPAW, shameful plug. I've attended several WIPA conferences, and it's for me, it's like a family reunion. I get to see all my friends from California. I get to see all my friends from Colorado, Arizona, Texas, Idaho, New Mexico. It was a beautiful, beautiful experience, and I'm grateful for it. Have a good night, Darden. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would encourage the two new guys. You know, this is a place that is safe, and it's a place that if you give it the opportunity, you can have an amazing experience, and you can have friends from all over this country and all over this world. And you can have a life that is infinitely better than you ever expected. I'm not going to say that my worst day sober is better than my best day drinking and using, because there was a lot of times that those days saved my life. And there was a lot of those days that it was still working, and when it was still working, I was on cloud nine. But what I will say is that I wouldn't trade my best days using and drinking for my best day sober, because those are infinitely better. You know, ironically, I thought I would try to take up my full 30 minutes. But I also understand that sometimes there's just not much more to say. There is one thing I like to share. How many of you guys have gone to rehab? How many of you guys did the relapse prevention lists and triggers lists? And they said, this is what's going to keep you from drinking and using, if you can remember those things. In the big book on page 36, there's a story about a car salesman that goes out and sells cars out in the boondocks where he thinks he's going to sell a car back in the 30s. And he tells of his suddenly moment. The idea occurred to him that if he had a shot of whiskey and a glass of milk on it, it wouldn't hurt him on a full stomach, right? So my suddenly moments are very much like that. It wasn't suddenly I remembered my triggers list, or suddenly I remembered my relapse prevention list. It was suddenly the thought occurred to me that it's a beautiful warm day outside and it'd be okay to drink. See, and the only thing that prevents me from having that suddenly moment turning into that, now if I have continued to take my personal inventory as it talks about in 10, 11, and 12 and continued to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand him, when those suddenly moments happen, it gets to be, and suddenly the thought occurred to me that I probably should go out and talk to a newcomer. Or suddenly the thought occurred to me I should go to a meeting. Or suddenly the thought occurred to me that maybe I should do some step work and call my sponsor. And that's what my daily reprieve is. And that's what gives me the opportunity to make sure that I don't have to have that obsession return. And that's all completely contingent upon a power greater than myself. The cool thing about AA is that that power greater than yourself gets to be anything that you want it to be. Anything. Anything at all. For the longest time, the ocean was my higher power. Does anybody surf in here or been surfing? I'll say this and then I'll finish. I'll shut up. When you're first surfing, you get on your board and you're paddling out and you're trying to get past the break. And the break is a lot like life. And you're going out, you're swimming out, you're paddling out, and you're trying to get past the break, and sometimes that break pushes you off your board and pushes you back about 20 feet. So you get back on your board and you keep paddling out, but once you get past the break, you're sitting out on the ocean, you're calm. And you turn your board around and you're looking out and you're waiting for that right wave to come in. And if you're in tune and you're focused, and almost in a meditative state, you can feel the ocean swell. And when you feel that right moment come, you feel that wave coming on, you turn your board around and you put in even more work. You start paddling and you start kicking and work really hard. And once you catch that wave, you feel that wave catch the board, and then you get to ride it for a little bit, do a little bit of turns, and then you end, and then you get to do it all over again. for a long time, that's what my higher power was for me. So I've got to work hard through life, pedal out past the break, and then I need to be still, and I need to wait for that right moment. And when the right moment comes along, I paddle real hard, and then I get to have that moment of zen. And that's kind of the way my higher power works for me today. I hope that I said something that means something to somebody. I hope that that those who are here, you stay. Don't just keep coming back, just stay. Because it's worth it. And with that, I'll take another 24.